I'm Naomi Grimley and I've come to this beach outside Los Angeles between Santa Monica and Venice. It's a beautiful sunny day, rays of the sun are bouncing off the water. And it's almost exactly this spot that one of the most famous women in America disappeared.
It's a Tuesday, it's May 18th, 1926, around 3 in the afternoon, and Amy likes to go down to the shore.
Social historian Kim Cooper takes us back nearly 9 decades. Amy Semple McPherson was at the beach to take a swim and write a sermon. Her loyal assistant Emma Schaffer was with her.
Ms. Schaffer needs to go back to the hotel to make a telephone call. She makes quite a short call, and by the time she gets back to the tent, she doesn't see Amy in the water anymore. She assumes that she must have gotten out. She looks for her. She does not see her. She talks to the lifeguards. No one has seen her. And there is no sign of Amy.
Rumors of Amy Semple McPherson's disappearance swept through L.A. By the next morning, one of the newspapers had printed a picture of her on the front page with a simple question: drowned or kidnapped? So who was this woman who sparked so much interest? What impact did she have on America? And why does her dramatic life still matter? On the BBC World Service, this is the story of Sister Amy.
As many as the Lord our God shall call, and if ever the church needed the Holy Ghost today, oh, don't be like Miss Muffet and let the spider, the old devil, frighten you away. Dig deep, take hold of God's fullness for you. Pray the Lord.
Amy Elizabeth Kennedy was born on a farm in Ontario, Canada, in 1890. As a teenager, she'd gone along to hear an Irish Pentecostal preacher speak in her local town. Before long, she'd married him and joined his life on the road. But a trip they took to Hong Kong as missionaries ended in disaster. Both she and her husband fell ill with malaria. He died, she survived, pregnant with her first child. When Amy returned to America, she herself felt the call to travel and preach.
She would, you know, stand out and stare at the sky in some strange town, and people would come and gather around her because it's this pretty girl who's clearly lost her mind. And then she'd open her mouth and say, "Come with me to the tabernacle." And her voice was so lovely, and she'd have rented a place. And the group that had gathered around her to figure out what was wrong with her would follow her. That's how she would draw people in.
She turned out to be enormously popular. What made her most popular was her seeming ability to lay hands on the sick and to heal them. People would come to see her, believing that she could cure them of various sicknesses.
Matthew Sutton is the author of Amy Semple McPherson and the Resurrection of Christian America. Word soon travelled about these gatherings. Whenever Amy arrived in a town, she'd be greeted by people on crutches or with arms in plaster, hoping she would lay hands on them.
There were a lot of people who came to see what they saw as a freak show, and there were others who came legitimately to be healed. And then there were always accounts that the journalists would relay of people who came as skeptics and walked away as converts.
This popularity, though, came at a price. McPherson's second husband was unimpressed that his wife was more interested in her career as a preacher than she was with her domestic duties. He filed for divorce. Now a single mother with 2 children, Sister Amy looked west to find a more permanent base for her ministry.
Amy came to Los Angeles in 1919 for the opportunity.
Here's social historian Richard Shave. He hosts bus tours of Los Angeles with his wife Kim Cooper. The three of us spoke in Echo Park, steps away from McPherson's temple and parsonage.
I think Sister fell in love with the idea of putting on big shows. She comes to Los Angeles, she starts raising money for the temple. She enters the Rose Parade. She wins. She wins, her float wins in the Rose Parade.
By 1923, Amy Semple McPherson was so successful, she built this place. It's the Angelus Temple in Echo Park. It's shaped a bit like a wedding cake with a white circular frontage and a domed roof. Perched on top in her day was a neon cross which could be seen for miles around. And next to that, 2 radio masts. They carried her services across the airwaves to listeners at home.
All right, now out in Hollywood, the transcription company is tuning in on this station, and they're getting those big platters ready to start running, and they're going to record now this sermon, and the next voice you hear will be that of Amy Semple McPherson. Let's give Sister McPherson a little encouragement as she starts this sermon.
The temple opens, and she is the personification of everything you think about in Los Angeles. She owns a radio station. She started her own religion, basically.
Jesus began to touch her. She turned over and said to me, "Sister, the pain has stopped. The pain is gone." Or is it the thing seems to be melting away? And I came back up to the platform, and in a little while I saw two of my faithful, loyal workers go over and take her by the hand, and she rose to her feet.
She feeds people their souls and their stomach. She clothes people. She gives them everything they're looking for.
Divine healing is not something new of the 20th century. Divine healing is as old as the Bible itself, and the Word of God endureth forever.
So what happened to this magnetic leader in 1926? Where had she gone? Kim Cooper tells us more about the mood in LA on the day she went missing.
That night, her mother, Minnie, takes the podium. You have to remember, all of this is being broadcast by radio. Minnie, by the end of the night, says, "Amy went down to Venice Beach this afternoon with her secretary. She went into the water. She didn't come out. Sister is gone, and we know she is with Jesus."
Well, after a while, crowds began to gather here, search parties formed, and followers of the preacher woman came to keep a vigil on the sand.
People on the beach were listening on the radio, and so as Minnie would preach or as other people would preach, they would be tuned in. A young man named Robert Browning, 26 years old, was in Manhattan Beach, and he thought he saw something floating out in the water that could have been Amy. He swam out. It was a couple of dead seals. He drowned in the course of trying to get out to see this. So people were, in some cases, dangerously excited and passionate and interested.
We are now walking into Angelus Temple.
Back in Echo Park at Angelus Temple, I met Steve Zeleny. He's the archivist for the Four Square Church. That's the denomination that McPherson created.
The way that it looked in 1923 is still apparent in that you can see the stained glass windows, monstrous stained glass windows. In the upper deck, you can see wooden chairs, which we left up there. Those are the original chairs from 1923.
It was built like a theater rather than as a traditional church. There were three levels, there were balconies, there was a stage in the center, there was an orchestra pit.
If we look straight up, we can see what was at the time the largest cement freestanding dome of its time, painted on the inside to be clouds.
McPherson began advertising and began developing what she called dramatic sermons. And so every Sunday night, rather than give a traditional message, she would instead enact a story from the Bible, and she drew on the talents of Hollywood. She had the best actors, the best set designers, the best costumes, the best makeup artists, and professional lighting. And so she would create these stories, these dramas, in which biblical stories would come to life.
Moses heard the sound of the trumpet. He heard the thunder. And then he heard the voice of God. And this was what God spoke.
No other God before me.
So it's true theater.
Oh, it's always absolutely true theater. What was surprising, though, was that most of these were developed within 1 week. She would call the construction crew and say, "I need you to build me a 20-foot Trojan horse that's hollow on the inside that I could have people hiding in. Or I need you to build me a huge ship. The bow has to stick out 20 feet, and we need to have guns on it that have smoke coming out." The sets were massive.
Almost more Las Vegas than it is L.A.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, at the time, for sure. Compared to what was available, I'll use the words of Charlie Chaplin, "It's the best show in town."
Remember the Sabbath day. Keep it holy.
And a good show needs a good costume. Jane Shaw is Dean for Religious Life and Professor of Religious Studies at Stanford University.
You look at photographs and footage of her, you can see that she's wearing something that looks quite like a stole around her neck. She's wearing a tunic often with a big cross on it, but she's also a very glamorous person. She's very aware of fashion. She's aware of making herself an appealing person. One might even say an alluring person, actually. Remember, this is the era of Houdini as well. So, you know, she learns from other people's stunts.
Amy Semple McPherson fused religion, entertainment, and technology decades before televangelism did the same.
She invented a genre, and it was right in the middle of Hollywood. When Sister needed a camel for her visual sermon on Sundays, she called down the street to the Max Cenic Studios, and they sent over a camel.
How obliging of them.
Well, everyone wanted her to work in motion pictures. That's the other thing. People wanted her to make movies, and she didn't want to do that. Charlie Chaplin came by in a car every Wednesday evening and took her out to dinner. He helped invent Sister.
Their friendship must have been a bit of an unlikely one, given their different sort of paths in life.
No. It's lonely at the top.
How did it go down with the other preachers in town?
Divided. People are being healed. I mean, God is working there. How do you say, you know, what she's doing is wrong, it's of the devil, and all these people are getting saved, and they're getting healed, and in your church, nothing is happening? How do you deal with that?
Any religious leader who's going to claim to be able to heal or to speak in tongues is probably going to attract some criticism. A glamorous woman is even more likely to attract criticism, questions, you know, all of that.
In the middle of 1926, rumors began to spread that she was having an affair with her radio engineer, a guy named Kenneth Ormondson. The acoustics in the temple were very good, and so there had been stories that when she was doing sound checks for the radio with Ormondson, that they sounded too comfortable, too confident, that they knew each other too well. And they had also been seen having dinner together, and this was something that McPherson addressed very forthrightly. She said he needed counseling, that they had gone out so that she could minister to him, but of course other people saw more nefarious intentions in the fact that they were going out to dinner alone.
I'm Naomi Grimley, and here on the BBC World Service, I'm exploring the extraordinary life of Sister Amy Semple McPherson, a woman who invented broadcast evangelism and who mysteriously vanished back in 1926.
People were consulting Ouija boards to determine what happened. They brought in psychologists or psychotherapists to talk about maybe McPherson had amnesia. Or maybe she had just wandered out over the sea. She had walked on water and just kept going. And so nobody knew quite what had happened, but there were all kinds of rumors.
Depending on how much they liked Amy and how close they wanted to abide to actual verifiable truth, different newspapers took different angles.
For example, the story was, oh, she had gone to have a secret abortion. Well, she had had a hysterectomy 13 years before that. And so obviously anybody who did any research would know that that's not even a possibility, but it sold a lot of newspapers.
One of my favorite rumors, a local newspaper speculated that there had been a sea monster recently sighted off of Venice Beach, and they believed that maybe this sea monster had swallowed McPherson whole. People were scared, and they were also hopeful. They believed that maybe she would come back. Maybe if she was dead, she would actually rise from the dead. Maybe this would be the greatest miracle yet.
I'm back on the beach near Santa Monica Pier from where Amy Semple McPherson disappeared. 5 weeks later, after those search parties had given up all hope of finding her, she dramatically reappeared. But she didn't wade out of the sea, miraculously resurrected. Rather, she popped up in a hot and dusty border town in Mexico.
She comes to a family's home and she knocks on the door and she says she's been walking for hours and hours, having escaped from a weird little hut where she was held captive by three people. The story that she gives is that she was indeed alone on the beach and a young couple came up to her after Ms. Schaffer had walked away and they said, our sick baby is in the car, please won't you pray over our baby? And as she bent into this car that they led her to, she was shoved inside and chloroformed.
And so her story was that she had been kidnapped and held for ransom in Mexico, and that ultimately she had escaped, that one afternoon they left her alone to go get some groceries and some other supplies, that they had left a can with some jagged edges, and so she was able to use those edges to cut the ropes that had been holding her to her bed and then climb out a window and make the trek across the desert to safety in the small border town of Agua Prieta.
When she returned on the train from Arizona, thousands and thousands of people had gathered to see her.
Well, you can imagine, you know, car horns going off, and yeah, it was quite the celebration. It was monstrous. But then almost immediately, what you had were newspapers playing up some kind of a sordid affair that had gone on.
She didn't have water, she wasn't that dirty, her shoes weren't that worn, and she wasn't that sunburnt. And so almost immediately there was skepticism about her story.
She came back to a very different town with a very different attitude towards her, and she had to live with that.
Soon, enterprising reporters noticed that Kenneth Ormison, the man that she had been rumored to have been having an affair with, had disappeared at exactly the same time.
The district attorney of Los Angeles convened a grand jury. It was to establish if there were any grounds to issue indictments against the alleged kidnappers in the Evangelist's version of events. Very soon, though, this turned into an opportunity to question Sister Amy about her private life.
Was she kidnapped? Who kidnapped her? There was never any serious investigation in terms of that, ever. It was always like, we got to get Amy.
It became clear that the district attorney was trying to pursue her on charges of perjury.
You know, she was definitely hung out to dry by men who resented her power, who resented her charisma, who resented everything she represented, which was a threat to the traditional power structure.
McPherson had gone from celebrity of the city to somebody who was a pariah, somebody that the city fathers wanted nothing to do with.
Ultimately, after two public hearings, prosecutors were unable to bring McPherson to trial for perjury. Any evidence that did exist was circumstantial. So the circus that surrounded Los Angeles Municipal Court melted away. The Four Square Church maintains that McPherson's kidnapping story was the truth and that rumors of an affair were cooked up.
The biggest problem, I would say, would be media. One of the Hearst reporters phrased it this way. He said, Amy, the good girl, doesn't sell headlines, and we're in the business of selling headlines.
Some historians, like Matthew Sutton, have a different view.
I'm 99% confident that she had an affair. I mean, the circumstantial evidence is so strong. I suspect she ran away with Ormison, possibly thought she was going to run away for good, possibly never to come back. And then ultimately, after a month reading the newspaper, seeing what was happening, she decided to make this dramatic return. And so the kidnapping story was the best means she came up with for doing it.
To this day, if people know who Amy is, they know about her because of this supposed scandal, even though nothing was ever proven against her. They never found whoever took her away, and they never proved that she went away intentionally. It remains a big mystery.
But I'm sure that many people out there have their own particular troubles, only mine always somehow, unfortunately, seem to get into the headlines.
In 1929, Amy Semple McPherson built a second home near Lake Elsinore. It's about an hour and a half's drive southeast of Los Angeles.
It's like something out of North Africa or the Middle East. It's a white castle. It's got a crenellated rooftop with domes. One of the domes has a beautiful mosaic on it. And it looks really out of place.
Hi. This is amazing.
Erin Funk is a preacher for the Four Square Church and lives nearby.
To give people an understanding, I would say it would be the equivalent to Princess Diana. She was constantly being followed. That's kind of the best analogy that you could give, and people go, oh, yeah, okay. So she would enter the home through the tunnel. The tunnel would take her up to the rest of the house.
The Lake Elsinore Castle is a refuge from the press, but it also represented in many ways her movement away from the temple, from her ministry, her sort of fallen period, these years of wandering.
I love the elegance of it. It is just wonderful.
It really is a stunning room. When you walk into this room, and everyone, their breath is just, you hear that gasp, that.
Like, remember how my father used to have to get out and put axle grease every now and then on the wagon wheel when it would get all dry. That's how some of you folks appear with your shoulders, wrists, and elbows, especially around collection time. Things won't move at all.
For the next few years, she becomes everything that unfortunately fulfills many of the stereotypes of the charlatan evangelist, at least the fallen evangelist, the mistaken evangelist.
I mean, there's a sort of conflict between the luxury of this place and, of course, the deprivation that was going on during the Depression in L.A.
You know, she was blessed, and people loved her, and when you change people's lives, they want to give back to you. And so they gave back in the form of materials for this home and the things that went in the home, and, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
It was during this period that Amy Semple McPherson married her third husband. David Hutton was an actor who played a pharaoh in one of Amy's productions at the Temple.
David, I've never been so happy in all my life as I am right now.
Yeah, you know, with all our happiness this morning, I had something that kind of scared me a little bit. I saw a notice on the paper which said extra, and your name was across the top.
Oh, not my name in a newspaper.
Your name in the newspaper.
Oh, no. Well, dear, if that's the case, you know, don't be too excited about it. In cases like that, I just sing this song. You can talk about me.
You can talk about me.
Just as much as you please.
Yes, as much as you
but he was also a man with a colorful past.
The scoundrel, we call him.
A particular incident with a massage nurse gave the newspapers yet another irresistible twist in the story of Sister Amy. It also resulted in McPherson's second divorce.
She made a mistake, and she realized it, and then went on and didn't stop her ministry, didn't stop her impact. She changed thousands of people's lives because she loved the Lord.
Do you hear that playing? The idea of a fallen evangelist caught the imagination of Cole Porter. He wrote the musical Anything Goes in the 1930s as McPherson's reputation unraveled.
Will you be ready to go when I blow my horn?
It features a sensuous sermonizer, Reno Sweeney, an evangelist turned nightclub singer, and a woman who knows how to use her style and feminine charms to thrill her audience.
I was low, Gabriel, low. Mighty low, Gabriel, low. But now since I have seen the light, I'm good by day and I'm good by night. So blow, Gabriel.
Her supporters, though, believe the accounts of her life tend to overlook her good work on the streets of L.A.
During the Depression, when the government was then starting to shut down their government programs and starting to shut down their lunch programs, she sold this place and put the money back into the commissary.
Commissary is something which starts in the basement of the parsonage, which we're right across the street from now. People come 24 hours a day. Food and clothing.
Soup. There was a soup kitchen there. They had blocks of cheese, obviously rice, beans, those sort of things. So when the government was stopping their programs, she was ramping up with her programs and didn't turn anyone away, and it was never closed.
By the time the commissary closes at Sister's death, over 1.5 million people have been clothed and fed. It's a huge number in Los Angeles. That's rivaling that of anything the public sector, the county of Los Angeles, as an entity is providing. She was really a visionary in that.
And so for as many personal problems as she had in her life and as many controversies as she raised, the fact that she had served LA's needy at their most dire hour, at the height of the Great Depression, is something that everybody respected her for.
On the 27th of September 1944, Amy Semple McPherson was found dead in a hotel in Oakland, California. A lifelong insomniac, she'd taken too many sedatives, though her followers insist it wasn't a suicide. Her body was flown back to Los Angeles, where she lay in state for 3 days and three nights at the temple she had built for her groundbreaking movement.
McPherson's significant because she was doing something that many religious leaders were not doing at the time, by blending conservative faith with spectacle with a great show. But she's also significant today. Hers is a story that continues to resonate very powerfully, very widely, because she was a woman who defied traditional gender roles. She was somebody who was able to integrate true religious faith with the latest technologies, and she was somebody who was able to make the most of new forms of essentially mass media, of Hollywood celebrity. And so for all of these reasons, people look to her and they see many, many different things. Some see a great religious pioneer, others see a charlatan, others see a lonely woman who tried to escape with a lover and got caught. But whatever she was, it's a story that people can often relate to today just as well as they could have in the 1920s and 30s.
Lord, help me to be a real Christian, and to only publicly before mankind bring a revival to this America that we love, and to the world, for Jesus' sake.
I'm Naomi Grimley. This program was produced by Nick White. It was edited by Hugh Levinson. The